All right. Well, I am recording locally.
Recording locally also.
Sweet. Do you wanna count us in?
3, 2, 1. Let's jam.
I mean, that was like a weirdly sort of portentous countdown you did, which I liked a lot.
I'm feeling very portentous. We did read a magical realism book, but I'm feeling portentous rather than pretentious. That's right. It's left unread. We're leaving the countdown clap and sync point in because we did a fun little Cowboy Bebop thing. And
beautiful intro. Mm-hmm. Beautiful segues. Some of the best segues ever to have been done, they're saying.
They're calling me the man with the segue.
Magical realism, folks. They don't want me to do it. Should I do it? I should do it. Magical realism. So,
should there be a convenience store worker who's also an angel? The Democrats, they don't want me to have a convenience store worker who's also an angel, but I think we're going to let him spread his wings very soon.
Yeah, the crooked media have been trying to keep you from reading avant-garde experimental Latin American literature, and we are here to remedy that. We're sort of the Q of experimental Latin American literature in a lot of ways.
Hang on. What would magical realism Q look like? But Q drops are written in a bit of a magical realist style.
Something yeah, Q like is that. The first American, like WASP American style of magical realism. I mean, people talk about like Thornton Wilder and stuff. No. Like you can't. It's Q. Q was the first one to ever do it. And you know, they said a white boy couldn't do magical realism, but thanks to the paranoid style in American politics, we made it happen.
They said a white boy like me could never come up with an expansive forest with imaginary wolves in it.
That's right.
An enigmatic man with a pool.
You're aware, of course, that my thing the past few episodes has been smooth and striated terrain, right? And I thought I would sort of smooth some terrain. I thought I would sort of talk about a book which has some landscapes, some terrains, and some focuses on terrains in it. And so that's why I've picked this week. So are we doing this weekly?
It's every 2 weeks. It's fortnightly.
This fortnight's book, The Tiger Syndrome by Cristina Rivera Garza.
Now, just to jump in here for a second for non-British accented listeners, that would be the Taiga Syndrome, not what you might have heard Alice say, the Tiger Syndrome, which would be a different book entirely.
See, this is interesting. I wanted to talk about this particularly because this is a book in large part about language and translation and interpretation. Even when I tried to sort of trail this episode on mainline TF, I knew when I said the author's name, I was butchering it, right? Because I'm non-rhotic. I can't say Cristina Rivera Garza in the right way. It turns Angloid in my mouth, right? So too, the Taiga. Is it Taiga?
I think so. I come from a country, one of a few countries in the world that has Taiga.
The muskeg syndrome. And I mean, in Spanish, it is el mal de Taiga, which is sort of doesn't convey syndrome. It conveys literally the evil of, but also sort of like the sickness of, and
the
sort
evil,
of the translation.
Like an evil eye.
Yes.
That's how I interpreted the original, right? It says that the evil is not the sort of intentional wrongdoing in this case, in the original title. The evil is like that kind of strange miasma.
Yeah, and it's also a sickness, but it's a sickness not in like a sort of a transmissible sense, but in the sense of like you would say seasickness, for instance. The Taiga syndrome is a translated from Spanish novella, experimental avant-garde novella by Rivera Garza, who has been called like one of the greatest writers working in Mexico at present, living. And it's a very low, insubstantial little thing. It's like 120 something pages. But there's a lot there. And I was really curious to kind of like throw this at you. I had a choice of two novellas that she's written, this or The Iliac Crest. And I picked this one to throw at you and sort of see what you made of it. To continue in this quest of like dragging you away from like sort of bolt guns and blasters.
I mean, after all of these sort of, let's say, experimental Latin American fiction, because this is the second piece of experimental Latin American, or at least Latin American oriented fiction that I've read now in the last month, I definitely do need a book that contains the phrase, brother captain Ordinus Pertinax, and something like, if you want to know the trick, by the way, for naming space marines, it's just anything, any kind of Latin sounding last name, and then one of the names of the four emperors.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And then, you know, it's a, he'll
everyone
be,
loves to be a sort of like, a preterite major Caiaphas or whatever. Oh, yeah.
They're so good at that. Yeah. And then doing something like, feeling the heft of his chainsword while he intones, by the teeth of Baal and the light of the emperor, you shall not see the dawn, heretic. Something like that, you know? Something mm-hmm. that's really yeah. just over the top and beats you over the head with the premise, you know, mm-hmm. where the characters, all of whom have names, will have their like fight actions deeply, intricately described, and then you mm-hmm. know what everyone's doing. The Chaos Space Marines are here to take over the planet. The normal Space Marines are here to shoot the Chaos Space Marines. That's sort of it.
This is, although curiously, this does have a relationship to Chaos, but this is not a novella in which it is clear what everyone's doing. Mm-hmm. I would say quite the opposite.
Yeah.
I'll say, I
don't just want to give my impressions of it as, this wasn't genre fiction. My impressions
no, but
of
it. It's a good starting point to be like, no, this is unclear in a lot of ways. It's difficult, right?
Because one of the things about genre fiction, right, this doesn't just mean sci-fi, but this also means things like romance and so on. It's meant to make you. It's genre fiction often has a right answer. There is a certain way to experience the book, which is why genre fiction tends to attract people whose relationship with culture is curatorial.
Yeah, when we say a formula, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, indeed. And so, for example, everyone who cares knows what a space marine is, but everyone also knows the conventions of a bodice ripper or a sort of a French farce or a thriller. These things are set down patterns. And the point of literary fiction, like the couple of pieces of literary fiction that we've read on this show, is precisely to break out of the certainty of genre fiction, or indeed of quite a bit of literary fiction as well, right? To break out of that certainty, set down ways of seeing and being and reading and imagining and stuff, and instead to try to engage with a lot of ambiguity. Like, for example...
Yeah, well, like, I mean, I read a really interesting interview with Marlon James in The Guardian the other day where he says, like, a lot of literary fiction is formulaic too. Mm-hmm. You can sort of like play with these things from either side.
Mm-hmm. And so what this book does, I think, is even if it is formulaic, and this book is actually quite formulaic in one sense, because it's written as a kind of take on fairy tales, but the actual act of reading it, this construction of the sentences, writing sentences that are fragmentary and wrong and might be strangely constructed, like you notice, right, that Garza, whether this is an artifact of translation or something that she intended, frequently starts sentences with words like that and this, you know, that I had not done this for a long time. And
it's both. It's both. Like in the Spanish, there are sentences that start with que, right? Like, you know, in the sense of that which. And like it's very much intentional to have this sort of like slightly awkward sentence composition that at times is quite difficult to read, I find.
Yeah, I was going back quite a bit while we were reading this. And it's the sense when you're reading it is almost of getting kind of stuck. It's not prose that you trip over. And I don't want to keep going back to bashing genre fiction, right? Because I fucking love genre fiction. It's just course, that yeah. I think it's a worthwhile comparison when talking about style before we get into the content and the themes and some of the images and so on, is that this kind of writing, this experimental writing, and not all literary fiction is experimental, right? But this is this kind of experimental writing is meant specifically to avoid what most genre fiction does, which is you forget you're seeing the words, right? You don't revel usually, ordinarily. There are some exceptions to this, such as one book that I promised that we will read on this show. You know the one. But there is, because in fact, in that book as well, right, Blindsight, the story is told by an unreliable narrator who foregrounds his own unreliability, much as the detective or the ex-detective does in this one. But it means that, well, you even though it's a very short book, you actually can't read it quickly or you'll miss everything, because you'll miss like, oh, well, that's a slightly awkwardly constructed sentence. What's that doing there? How does it fit in with everything around it? And you're like, oh, yeah, well, this is kind of supposed to be, one thing we keep coming back to is I'm a detective. I'm on a mission in the Taiga to do something. What I'm doing is quite abstract. I mean, in the one sense, what I'm doing is quite set down. I'm going to find and bring back a woman who has left her husband, and her husband is convinced that she wants to return. And on the other hand, it's sort of quite abstract, because it's like, well, wait, why? What? The only evidence that he has that she wants to return is some sort of quite cryptic telegrams. Why telegrams? It's set in 2011. Is it set here on Earth? And well, I say it is set here on Earth, and the answer is kind of. You know,
what's interesting is that there become sort of like increasing layers of abstraction. And so if we want to talk about genre and we want to analyze this strictly from the forms of genre, what we're talking about here is something that is simultaneously literary fiction, a detective thriller in the sort of noir mode, and a fairy tale. And it sort of plays all of these things off against one another. So ostensibly, you start with a detective thriller that is this disgraced sort of ex-detective turned writer being, you know, accepting this job to like go into the Taiga and go and retrieve this woman on behalf of her husband. That is then immediately something that she sort of understands as a fairy tale, as Hansel and Gretel going into the forest. And is then sort of like revealed to be something that you can't quite explain in those terms, and something that's sort of stranger than either of those.
If we want to talk about the detective, actually, there was one, what the way that she describes herself towards the middle of the book is a description I particularly enjoyed. So this is the description that of the detective sort of given by herself towards the middle of the book. That I would have liked to be a housewife, I sometimes thought. Even a slightly sad housewife. Instead of wandering around faraway lands, trying to answer impossible questions, there were times, knowing this was improbable, I would have preferred to be a housewife. But I wasn't, and never had been, and never would be. Instead, I was a person who walked over lots of sharp stones, asking if anyone had seen anything odd. A hand, maybe a little hand to be exact, on a wall, or on the wall of a dream. I might be a person who shivered, but I could take the cold.
Which is as hard-bitten as, like, any sort of like Dashiell Hammett bullshit, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'd say the elements that appealed to me most about this novel were the noir ones. The sort of the scenes of seediness when she's looking at the lumberjacks and the brothel and the sort of extremely magical realism scene. I mean, okay, there's no point really going in order because it's such an odd story.
Yes, and also there's if you try to answer the question of like if you try to synopsize this book, if you try to say what happens in it, it's quite difficult because a lot of it is very ambiguous, a lot of it is confused, and on purpose. Like that's one of the things that I really like about it is that it's a book in part about investigation and about translation, and it's sort of like explicitly linking those two things, that every time you receive information, you have to consider where it came from, who told you this, what is it being filtered through, who are you hearing this through? And it always keeps you at that remove, it always keeps you outside the window.
Yeah, well, the window also sort of, the window as a sort of literary device of characters in border in areas between the inside and the outside, from one room to another. It's looking out, looking into windows, looking out of windows. A kid peers through a window at some adults having sex and tries to explain it in those terms. Like, well, if someone doesn't really know about it, how would they describe it? Right. And yeah, indeed. The same thing will frequently be described by different people in different ways. So like sex is very frequently described in this book, and it's described for pleasure, for procreation, for commercial purposes, as seen in a brothel, as seen by like a kid peeking through a window. And so the same thing, when looked at from different directions, ends up resolving into entirely different vistas. And it's even more important to know that half or more of the stuff that's being told to the detective is being told to her by her translator, who I think in a less thoughtful book, or a book that was less concerned with the places in between, with how things are, how information is mediated and stuff, would have faded into the background. And after being introduced, you would forget they're there, except for at a few moments maybe. But the translator, this person who's supposed to just be there for being a sort of tool almost on the detective's research, is probably the like the other main character, right?
Yeah, genuinely. And it's you know, a man, crucially, with a female detective, but a man who's like native to the region. And it's sort
of
like,
he's not really.
No, that's true. It's sort of left ambiguous. It's suggested that he is, and then it's suggested that he isn't. He's from here, but he's not. It is ambiguous for sure. But they don't even speak the same language that the translator is speaking to the people that he interviews. They're speaking a third language that they have in common. And you get this sort of like this agony of someone says something that is clearly very important, and then you wait for the translation, and you don't know how much you can trust the translation, how much it's being interpreted, how much it's being censored knowingly or not. Mm-hmm.
And we're reading this in translation.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it's an incredibly intimate relationship between the ex-detective and her translator. It's sort of framed in these terms where the taiga is like it's a sexualized environment in a lot of ways. And at one point, sort of like while hiking, he says women only think about sex. And she sort of like stands up for herself a bit to this, and is sort of left wondering if maybe he's not sort of like inadvertently misogynistically arrived at something sort of important with it.
And again, like it's, you know, women only think about sex. That's also an incredibly ambiguous sentence. Is women only think about the act of sex? Women only think about things in sexed terms? Women only think about how like sex and as it relates to gender? Like, and I think that's sort of, again, left ambiguous on purpose. And you can sort of wonder the different how that idea is then sort of repeatedly explored.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing I'll say, the one time I think that she sort of pushes a narrative on this is an unspoken thing I picked up on, which is that women cannot but think of sex because this is what men think of, this is what power thinks of, it's something that is imposed on women. And if we want to talk about imposition, right, I think we have to talk about the economics of this book, and there's a lot there too. Because, you know, to be a good detective, right, is to, you know, it's like being a good communist. You have to look at the material conditions. And in order to sort of like investigate the taiga, she has to like understand its material conditions. And it has this sort of spine of capitalism running through it. It's not a purely smooth terrain in the sense that we've been talking about. It is a frontier, right, that is being exploited and is being captured and is being destroyed and ruined by capital.
So I have a passage here, in fact.
Please.
We stop to examine a strange artifact peeking out of the ground, alerting us to something else inexplicable. A plane's instrument panel full of buttons and levers that someone at some point must have lost control of. Heavily rusted. When I looked behind us, the world seemed incomprehensible and eternal. Time. It is difficult to imagine what can't be described. The forest, for others, is less uniform and less forest than it felt to me, judging by the paths that we were crossing. The development of the timber industry had brought lumberjacks and businessmen alike. The needs of the lumberjacks had in turn brought cooks and merchants, usury and sex. In small rural houses around fires burned down to embers by heavy rust-colored machinery, men and women of different ages, covered by the same thermal coats, stretched and relaxed their muscles. From a distance, they looked like small nomadic tribes. Off they went, carrying only what was needed for daily survival, tethered by ropes to a world that, though far from the forest, still tugged at them forcefully. Money is not a hallucination, I repeated to myself, and the trees agreed with me. In the lumberjacks' pockets, in their gold teeth, in the chains that they wore around their necks, in their desire to leave forever, in their plans to return to some version of home that grew more remote the more they thought about it, money shines with the patina of something sad or impossible, something one should condemn. It's not a good life, the translator volunteered without my asking. Too many drugs needed to keep up the work pace, he said, cutting off a piece of an onion and bringing it to his mouth with the help of his pocket knife. Too much of, what's the word? Anxiety. Yes, too much anxiety. I did it for several years before I went to college, he continued. The pay is good. Sometimes it covered expenses. He stopped to spit. Then he looked toward the foliage, and he didn't say anything else for a while. It's impossible to live in those places for very long, he added, referring to cities. Too many people, too much noise.
Hmm. It's interesting that sort of like hesitation and ambiguity around the word anxiety, that word being sort of like reached for. And the take as like a psychological landscape is an interesting one.
Well, the way I sort of have it in my notes is that what if the zone in Stalker also had an economy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the thing is, talking about it as a psychological landscape brings us to the title, the syndrome, which is something that's described as it's a kind of madness, a kind of suicidal impulse that takes over people who like live in the taiga sometimes, where they feel that they have to get out, but there's, you know, 5,000 kilometers more of it. It just keeps going. And so they sort of like, they flee into nothing, presumably disappear and die. It reminds me a lot of, I'm going to talk about this every time I get the chance, Disco Elysium. And Disco Elysium has the pale for this, which is sort of like a climate change allegory, an entropy allegory. This sort of like featureless void that's like creeping in and consuming all sort of like matter. And it's much the same. It's this thing of distance and the sort of like perverse sort of like alteration of it that you get in these sort of like landscapes where you can sort of like go nearer and become further away, and things sort of like reverberate and redound upon each other.
In fact, I wanted to sort of probably possibly do this one later, but the descriptions of the landscapes are something that also stick with me as well, sort of to build on what you're saying. This is from just the very end of the book where they've discovered, I'm going to spoil the end. It's spoilers for the taiga syndrome.
Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. I mean, yeah, Nick Fury shows up and is like, it's called the Avengers Initiative. Did you read to the mid-credits scene?
Sorry. Well, Nick Fury shows up and recruits the magical realist Avengers. Like there is a woman who has a typewriter that means that she meets the characters she creates when she writes on it. There is a man who puppets himself.
Is that the bridge from the Bridge of San Luis Rey? Crazy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Copyright. Firstly, the magical realist Avengers is. Yeah.
Here's the thing. Like, there's a lot of superheroes who will just like beat the shit out of villains. But are there any who make the villains like really examine themselves and their own sort of like standpoint and ways of knowing?
Are there any who have a special paintbrush where they can hear? Where if they paint you, they can hear your thoughts. So this is the description of the landscape. I had never heard thunder in a place so packed with trees. The booming of the sky made me tremble. The wing beats of birds with no names and that couldn't have names. The violently clashing branches. The heart of the forest suddenly seemed to beat rapidly. Breathlessly is an adverb with rhythm. We all looked up at the sky in unison and looked back at the things on Earth. There was a translator, a detective, and a couple of fugitives. Once upon a time, there was. We kept looking at each other like that for a while, motionless, terrified, as if the world were churning and fearful that everything would turn upside down, that the heavens would abruptly vomit en masse. We had just begun to understand. So I think in addition to being described as a very foreboding, and because obviously nothing in this book can be just one thing, in addition to being described, as you say, as a kind of gray expanse of, you know, the void that you stare at until it stares back into you, it's also described as astonishingly beautiful. But it's also described as a kind of, through the glum, like, ledger logic of capitalism. You know, it is all of these things is the Taiga in the book, The Taiga Syndrome. Whoa, is that the Taiga from The Taiga Syndrome?
Yeah. It's interesting how much of a sense of place it has for something that isn't set anywhere. It's not in a named country. It's not in Russia or Finland or Canada. It's just sort of, we assume it is current time, current Earth, right? But these things
aren't
important. I don't
even assume that it's current time, current Earth, though, to be honest.
Mm, that's fair.
Because the whole, all of the, I think one of the things about magical realism is that trying to place it in the kind of box where you're like, all right, this is set roughly recently in roughly this place. Here is a recording of the events that happened. It just so happens that they didn't because it's fiction, right? Mm-hmm. There is a sense where it's set in the same Earth of fairy tales, this kind of theoretical place, a kind of generic setting. You know what
sure.
I mean?
It's interesting that you mentioned reporting, because that's also a sort of a key thing that I want to dig into, is the detective is hired for this task by the husband, who is an interesting character in his own right, and one I want to get into later. And her job is not only to find this couple, which she already sort of, like, as soon as she takes it on, knows is very, very unlikely, but also to send back these reports. These reports, they never get sent until the very end when they're all compiled together, but the style changes as she gets sort of further away from the cities, from the coast. They change from this sort of like dry reportage into something more like a novel, into something more fictional, into something more impressionistic. And it's sort of like it's a descent into strangeness, into the unusual, and the sort of like the alienation of that, and not really sort of remembering why you were there in the first place, or the forms that you had to sort of like take on in order to do your job in, you know, the rest of the world.
Yeah. And in what world would you hire someone to produce a report that included descriptions of their frequent hallucinations of a wolf? Well, you would say, good detective. But that makes sense in the Taiga, because it is really, because what ultimately it is, the process of finding this couple is as much a, you know, mental process of being in and dealing with the Taiga, this place, this bigness, this that has so much to it, whether it's extractive industry, whether it's beauty, whether it's, you know, bleakness, right? That the idea is that it does something to you. So it makes sense that as you go in there and the Taiga comes into you, the setting sort of permeates yourself, you know, that all of a sudden it is important to include the various hallucinations of wolves in your reports to the person who has hired you, but I don't know, like paid with a song that makes you sense what you sense when you were a child.
Yeah. Of course, when she gets back to the world, and she sort of like hands in this report, it goes over about as well as you'd expect, right? If you hire a detective in sort of a usual place, a place of usualness, to go and find your wife, and you receive back, you know, I imagine this kind of like dog-eared sort of like exploding dossier with you know, stuff falling out of it and like strange runes and like bits of bark and stuff and you know, like rusty nails through it and everything. If you get this back, you know, the result is what? Incomprehension, anger.
You know what it reminds me of, in fact, is it's a very short House of Leaves, basically. Again, the compilation of pieces of writing that don't really exist, reporting of events that didn't happen. It's just that this is the story of the production of the report, in effect. Whereas House of Leaves is supposed to be like the report, just a fictional version of it. But it's the same sort of or similar premise, just at one step more removed, which is the attempt to. And I think actually I'll go back to your use of the word world, right? Where if we think back to the very first book we did for this, Seeing Like a State, we talked about worlds as limited ways of seeing that simplify and smooth things down.
Sure.
I don't know if this was intentional.
you bring that smooth shit back here to the striations, you're going to get striated, you know?
You bring this smooth shit to the Tega, and we're going to describe in grim detail, like, what happens to your body while you chew in a way that's supposed to fucking gross you out.
Yeah.
But the city is the place of the smoothness, the place where the fact that she's including her hallucinations of wolves, that she's including how she felt when she went to the strip club where the puppets have sex. I told you this is magical realism. All of that.
There is a puppet sex scene.
There is a puppet sex scene, which I alluded earlier to the most magical realism scene ever. When you walk through a kind of bordello that's a very sort of lumberjack strip club and go through a kind of velvet curtain to a very sort of sophisticated back room of, you know, people in elegant dresses and tuxedos. And then a waiter comes and on like a silver covered tray opens it up and there are two puppets having sex. That's magical realism.
That's one of the things that magical realism is. Yes.
Yeah. But that's, to me, that's just like, that is probably... Like, of all of the scenes of this book, that is the most magical realism, capital M, capital
for sure.
R.
It's definitely the strangest, but the thing is, you can go back and you can try and reduce this shit down. And that's, I think, part of the fun and part of the interest of it for me is having these competing things in your head at once of... your Mulder and your Scully, right? Your rational explanation for this, which is... It's a brothel in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of like fucking weirdos with nothing else to do, and they just like this shit, man. It's just versus this is some kind of fucking homunculus ritual. It's like very entertaining, and like seeing the detective sort of grapple with that too.
We've talked about the homunculus ritual. Shall I just bring the text into it?
Yeah, please.
To pass through an even smaller door, he had to lift two heavy red velvet curtains. Once inside, the noise of laughter and glasses and music ceased. The multitude of clients shrank to a couple of groups of men and women dressed in elegant, neat clothes. Some were even speaking the language the translator and I spoke to each other. So language and translation is never far, even in like the weird homunculus sex scene, never far away. Mm-hmm. What are we waiting for? I asked after a few minutes when I realized that nothing was happening where we were. My murmur mixed with so many others, the anticipation clearly was shared. I don't really know, the translator said, disappointed. One of the women in the village assured me that what we were looking for was here. I'm going to skip a little bit down. Suddenly,
they've been set onto this, by the way, by a child's description of possibly sex, possibly a miscarriage, and possibly a strange homunculus ritual.
Suddenly, the voice of a woman overwhelmed everything, scraping the walls of the entire place. One or two sounds at the same time, both from one throat. Was that possible? Yes, it was possible. The syncopated rhythm of a brook, the gallop of a mare, or the song of certain birds. Even the color green, yes, a stone as it's rolling. When a waiter in a dark formal coat came into the room with the red velvet curtains carrying a tray in his gloved hands, I thought perhaps, like the others, that it was caviar. I should have suspected something when, placing it on the long, shiny bar made from the tallest evergreens, he smiled with only the left half of his face. It wasn't this man, but another in a black suit and gold-rimmed glasses who lifted the glass cover. It almost, correct, now, you're a real connoisseur of Bond. Did this not feel almost Bond-like to you, this scene?
It is. It is, absolutely. And, I mean, this is the thing. There's a lot of sort of nightlife things that it sort of evokes for me. It evokes Casino Royale, but it also strangely evokes Gravity's Rainbow a little bit. The Casino Hermann Göring. This sort of like, I don't know, you put a dude in a tuxedo and have him do some weird shit, that's the things that lights up for me.
Well, in this case, it's what lights that up for me isn't just the dude in tuxedo doing weird shit, it is the ritual of decadent consumption. The fact that there's another man who's clearly senior to the waiter who's removing the glass cover on the tray. You know, these kinds of things. That it really did give me Casino Royale as well. It is difficult to describe what is impossible to imagine. This line, I've actually already said it before. Like, it comes up a few times. As it's true, it's difficult to describe what it's impossible to imagine. And, you know, Garza is presenting you with several things that are impossible to imagine one after the other. Two miniature creatures seemed, at first glance, to be dolls, maybe 15 or 18 centimeters tall. The type of dolls that certain little girls still play with. When they began moving, I instinctively looked above them for the strings by which, from some real, though hidden place, a puppeteer was no doubt controlling them. A customer passing his hands horizontally over the dolls must have had the same idea, and had also arrived at the same conclusion, that their movement was in fact self-directed. Whether by will or desire, it didn't matter. I believed then that they were robots. I thought they must be the deranged creation of some lecherous man because, yes, those two miniature creatures with long hair and legs were in that moment tangled in an embrace that was certainly sexual. One, in fact, had mounted the other. The other, opening its companion's legs, entered her with hands and tongue. The other got on its knees and raised its tiny ass. And then this thing that's supposed to be shocking just becomes quite funny, right?
Yes, yeah. It's surreal. It's absolutely surreal. And it's sort of like this strangeness that you have. It's so sort of outside your context for it that you don't have anything left for it but to laugh.
One looked at us with real curiosity and the other looked at us with scorn. One moved its head towards the other and, opening its lips, pronounced words or emitted sounds that we couldn't hear, their hands interlaced. How much did you pay to get in here? I hadn't planned on asking the translator that. But out of all the questions that swirled around in my head, it was the first to come out of my mouth. Courtesy of a man with a pool, he said, not taking his eyes from the scene.
We got to talk about the man with the pool.
And everyone's talking about the man with the pool.
That's right. And the thing is, like, none of the characters in this are named, so it's just man with pool. Mm-hmm. But in the course of their investigation, basically, like, the investigation is not a very mobile one. They go to the a hut where the couple were seen. They keep asking questions until answers fall out. They just sort of stay in this small town or village for the most part. But the sort of the head man of this village, the only person besides her employer who seems to have any sort of like power to exercise, is like this local industrialist. Who has a pool and who feeds them enormous hunks of like steak made of reindeer, and has like sort of caribou leather armchairs, and it's sort of like he's sort of melded himself with the taiga in a way that's like very uncomfortable and sort of domineering.
Was that the man? See, another sentence beginning with the word that the man in charge of the local lumber industry wanted to understand, I would write in the report I would eventually send to the man who paced nervously in his bedroom in his head. See, that's a difficult sentence to diagram, but it gives it gives the sense of that we're snapping back to formality. It gives the sense that this is someone who nervously cares about how he's being presented. The most powerful man of the region was curious. What exactly had brought us from a place that he imagined was so distant, maybe even the most distant, to this corner of the world? A corner he considered, and in the strictest sense he was correct, his own. He offered us tea, then he offered us vodka. Between one thing and the next, a slight woman with almond eyes and long straight hair brought us bread and sea salt and small sprigs of something that looked like parsley but could just as easily have been dried seaweed. Then she served on a platter large hunks of meat that our host ate with his fingers, motioning us to do the same. I mean, I mentioned earlier as well the tongue in cheek, right? You know, watch out, or I'll describe chewing to you in a way that's horrifying. That also occurs in this part of the book. I remember the movement of jaws, constant and dreadful, opening and closing, chewing, swallowing. I remember how the voracity of my own chewing made me close my eyes. Sometimes pleasure is like that. Above all, I remember the sound of lips gnawing and talking at the same time, and the grease shining on them, and how my food slid down my esophagus slowly before falling into the cruel mechanism of my stomach. All those liquids and all that acid. I remember the noise of the gold chains around my forearms and wrists, how the metal sparkled at that time of day. What time? What day? And this is another...
It's so uncomfortable, isn't it?
We talk about, like, not just that you see things, but we talk about the soft skin under the eyelids. We don't talk about just thinking something, but we talk about the hollow and hard skull that you're a prisoner of. It's body, 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 body. There's constant body discussion in this book. There's never the sense that the characters are just sort of dolls with features on them, you know, like a lump with qualities. You're constantly reminded out here in the wilderness, this place that drives you insane, this place that exists so the timber industry can exist, that it's attracted all these people who don't really want to be here, who are constantly anxious, that they have stomachs and eyes and, you know, teeth, and that their lips are always greasy, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's a distancing effect in a Brechtian sense, and this is an incredible sentence that I just get to say. I can't believe I get paid to do this.
Yeah, for your job.
For my job, to say things like it's a Verfremdungseffekt, right? It's because you're making usual violence unusual. Like everyone eats, right? Almost everyone eats by like chewing. And so it's something that we're like absolutely habituated to, and in a city, it's not something that's like, you know, remarkable within the text, but you place it in this sort of like this terrain of strangeness. And suddenly it's sort of like, you can think about it in these terms of like, of violence and acid, and sort of like crushing and sliding.
Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't like to be reminded that I have skin. So I found that to be a particularly uncomfortable.
I got a tattoo today, and I tell you what, I love being reminded that I have skin. It's an incredible feeling. I often experience anxiety as a sensation of being too embodied, right? If we ever do Waiting for the Barbarians, which I think we absolutely should, one of the sort of the best things in that book is a description of torture as sort of like the imposition of the body onto principles, right? You think you believe in things, but if you're in enough pain, then you don't anymore, because that's the thing. You're within a body that can feel pain. You'll be made to feel pain until that overrides anything else, right? Much the same with anxiety, with fear, and I think in this novel too. It's like being too placed, being too embodied. And I think sort of like being embodied, being sort of like reminded that you live in one, is really like this two-edged sword in the Tegu syndrome. And it's something that's like very, very alienating. But when our protagonist, when the ex-detective sort of comes back from the Tegu changed by it, it sort of leads her to this place where she is almost zen about it. Again, spoilers for the Tegu syndrome. But
sorry, that makes me giggle each time.
Yeah. As she knew she would, she does not convince the wife to come home. And when she brings the husband, this man who, in a extremely spare piece of description, is described both sort of alluringly and threateningly as a man who like picks you up by the elbow, who like moves you by the arm without asking across a room in order to talk to you. When he gets back this, you know, sort of moss covered document that descends into sort of madness, he attacks her. right, for not bringing back his wife and for bringing him this sort of like this madness. And she's sort of remains unaffected by it in a lot of ways.
So, why did you really send me there? I asked when he showed up without warning on my doorstep. I assumed that desperation of pure chance had directed his steps towards me, although it was easy to imagine that he'd learned of my return from the agency handling my tickets. It is difficult to move without leaving traces. I invited him in because I had no choice, but what I really wanted, my real need, was to go out for a walk. There was a park two blocks away. I thought that there, by the pines and poplars, I'd be able to tell him. Beneath their branches, I would touch the bark of the trees, and I would tell him the truth. So, he said, tracing his index finger over the spines of some books. I warned you, I answered, turning my back to him. He sat on the sofa, opening his legs. Everyone wants a forest sometimes, he muttered to himself, looking at something through the window. You have nice light in here, he said, changing or perhaps circling back to the subject. I told him everything without pause, from beginning to end, using what I'd written in a little notebook with the black cover. My report, my account of the facts, my voice so calm, my hands ringing inside my mind. The Taiga is in fact a disease, a syndrome. Some people flee the monotonous terrain even when they know they can't escape. Some people take flight, suicidal, without considering the speed, their goal, or what lies beyond. Some of them dance. The more I talked, the more incredible it all sounded to me, the more implausible and the angrier. He snatched the little notebook from me, and as he flipped through it, he began to shout. Even falling out of love finally ends. Had I really told him that? My voice softer. Placating someone is also a spiritual exercise. Look at this, your knees. They are used for kneeling upon reality, also for crawling, terrified. You use them to sit on a lotus flower and say goodbye to the immensity.
And it's so interesting. That's the sort of like the big emotional hit that we, that really is spoilers for the Taiga syndrome. That it's
a book about the Taiga syndrome.
Yeah, we did. It's a book about falling out of love, and that the Taiga can be an emotional Taiga too. It can be an emotional landscape. And what it feels like to no longer be in love with someone and to leave someone can feel like the Taiga syndrome, can feel like sort of striking out into something that goes forever. And to sort of like be, you know, to exist on this plane of unconditional, possessive love, and to try and like strike out requires this sort of like abnegation of the self. It requires this strangeness, this unusualness. It requires you to get a bit fucking weird with it and become Buddhist and see a puppet sex show.
wait, I'll go back to what I said earlier when we talk about falling out of love. Some people flee the monotonous terrain even when they know they can't escape. Some people take flight suicidal without considering their speed, their goal, or what lies beyond. Some of them dance. Those can be well described, I think, as ways that you flee not being in love.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting to me because a lot of Rivera Garza's writing has sort of like been about these questions of knowing and not knowing yourself and escaping yourself and being sort of like embodied and being held prisoner by, you know, by yourself, and by others. The Iliac Crest does that a lot more sort of like with madness and with gender. But here it's very much the force of this very male man's love and how sort of like consuming and controlling it is that it like capitalism, right? It follows you out into this sort of like strange terrain and, you know, the tendrils of it sort of like extend out. But not successfully is the thing. It does not work out for him. Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't really get like a comeuppance or anything. It's just over.
Ends. His comeuppance is
the happy ending. That's the fairy tale ending. Yeah. Is the, you know, they live happily ever after, right? They get out.
Well, in fact,
he gets to learn that, like, you know, falling out of love is a thing that happens too.
Well, and the thing is, right, that towards the very, very end of the book, right, in the chapter A Closed Forest, which is, refers to the very curious thing of a wolf having escaped the local zoo. And so the officials are closing the forest, and she's like, "How do you close a forest?"
Yeah, it's quite catch 22 in these moments.
But this is, I think it's not a coincidence, or maybe it is. And I'm reading too much into it. That in this fairy tale, it is in fact the detective who is the wolf,
Yes. Yeah. No, you're absolutely not reading too much into it. She absolutely is.
Yeah. That she is the wolf, and because she's the representative of someone who is, she's the representative of the man who hired her, who is pursuing, right, the Hansel and Gretel figure, right? She's pursuing the hero who is, who, and if you think about it in love, she is trying to drag them out of the taiga. She's trying to drag them back to the world where they specifically do not want to be. And so,
and this conflict between genres again, between the sort of like male detective violent and the sort of like the fairy tale, which is, you know, sometimes now considered like childish and feminine, but contains this sort of like much deeper, richer vein of violence.
Well, it's when she realizes that she was not going to bring this man's wife back, and that really that she had no right to and probably shouldn't, and reaches that Zen place. This is how the book ends. I remember that, spoilers to the Taiga Syndrome. This is talking about the wolf. The wolf that's sort of constantly with her, whether it's a baby wolf patrolling where around the cabin they're staying in, something she hallucinates, the constant wolf. From a distance, he looked like a dog with thick fur, gray, in fact. Gray fur with darker tips, not quite black. His head slumping over his front paws added an air of weariness or of belonging to someone. If someone had passed my door, they would have thought, no doubt, that he was a domestic guard dog, a visible touch of loyalty or patience. The romance between master and pet in the glow of the afternoon sun. Time, its passage. Time that heals almost everything. In fact, I was going to ask him, but what are you doing here, when I stopped dead in my tracks? I remembered then the sound of his voice, the texture of his tongue, the way he talked about things, going around in circles, how the echo of his words lingered outside my ears before piercing my eardrum, the supple cartilage, the bone tissue, and the soft skin. I saw his eyes and I let him see me. I didn't know what it meant when he sat up on all four paws. Was it compassion or grace that flowed from his golden eyes? Not usually how you describe a wolf. We all carry a forest inside us. Yes, kilometers and kilometers of birch, fir, and cedars. A gray sky, things that never change. I thought he would jump at any moment. I saw his jaw, his saliva, teeth, and then air. Just air. That's how it all went. That, as always, I told the truth, yes, that I had. To me, that is the wolf vanishing.
Mm-hmm.
When she,
sure,
she sort of, when she abandons the pursuit, when she reflects, when she returns home, but when she takes off that, takes herself out of the role of pursuer, you know, the wolf then vanishes into air. And the wolf is, in fact, that's what I was thinking is, oh yeah, the wolf is the reflection of the ex-detective. That's that, mm-hmm, at that moment it vanishes.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about Red Riding Hood a lot, and she's sort of like, she's framed as Red Riding Hood, I think, misleadingly throughout the thing. And, you know, throughout there are, you know, little mentions of, you know, wolves and disguises. And I think it's quite apt to end on that note, because, yeah, absolutely. It's this position of being the sort of semi-domesticated wolf of this man, and yeah, I mean, so many of Rivera Garza's work that hasn't been translated, I understand, is about detectives and detection and femininity and masculinity. She wrote an entire book, which I would love to read in English, or, you know, learn Spanish for, about the sort of like gender swapped version of the femicides in Ciudad Juarez, and yeah, I think quite possibly of the same detective character. You know, there's an allusion to it in this, and yeah, it's an interesting sort of feminist deconstruction, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, you know, I'll say it's a book that I was 50-50 on until we talked about it.
For sure, yeah.
Essentially, I found, you know, I think even at the beginning, you'd say I found it a little bit difficult to read, because of the way that it's written, right? The way that it's written doesn't give you much. You have to go in and get it. You have to be your own wolf.
Absolutely. And I felt the exact same way. I enjoyed it when I read it, but at the same time, I would say a decent amount of it, I was like, oh, I don't understand this. And I'm going to sort of like turn this over in my head. Which I appreciate, because it got me to think like a detective. But yeah, no, it's definitely something that has been helped a lot by like talking it over with you.
Absolutely.
And I'm very grateful.
Well, it's one of the examples, I think, of like how how sort of literature, especially literature that's not for curation, right, can be best enjoyed, which is in discussion. You know, it's that reading something like this and really enjoying it fully has to be a social activity. It can't, or it's much more difficult, I think, to appreciate it purely on your own.
It's interesting, if you go and look at reviews of this book, which I did, I usually do for these things.
Well, like Google reviews? 1 star, well, too confusing.
Pretty much. There are reviews in reviews of books, which are, you know, very positive. But if you go and look on something like Goodreads for this, there are a lot of well-meaning people who will sort of like give this, you know, 3 stars to be like, well, it was very confusing, and I thought I liked it maybe, but I didn't really understand most of it. And I think that's a shame. I mean, I understand why. I don't want the novel or the novella to change because of it. I think that's a perfectly legitimate reaction to it. It's the kind of thing that I think really benefits from this kind of discussion and this kind of like closer reading.
And I think also, you know, you can go, it's not a long book. It's not an expensive book. You know, I think armed with this discussion, hopefully, you know, you can go and you can maybe find out places where we're totally full of shit or places that
we're setting you homework is the thing, because like a few of the books we've talked about are, to borrow a cursed phrase, things that we are reading so you don't have to. Right. But in this instance, no, it's something that like we are reading and you might enjoy reading more because of the fact that you have heard two morons misinterpret it totally.
Yeah, just I can imagine Garza listening to us and you're like, no, you fools, the detective wasn't the wolf.
Ah. Yeah, the thing is, right, we are going to get a bad grade in experimental fiction, something which it is normal to be afraid of and all too possible to achieve.
We're going to get a bad grade in the form of a beer that you cannot finish but goes stale.
I mean, she does literally teach. I think she's at like she's UT at, Austin, maybe.
Yeah, she's at Barry Weiss's fake university.
Yeah, so like, she's gonna give us a bad grade for like our woke reading of her novella.
I actually kind of like the idea that Barry Weiss's like fake university actually has an incredible and very legitimate experimental fiction department.
Yeah, it's like the one thing, you know, it's the one thing they really went quite hard on, having like a sort of very progressive like English faculty. And
the billionaire close. Like one billionaire funds them and is like, yes, fine, you can do like, I need you teaching the like, you know, anti-woke history course, whatever, anti-woke economics, all that stuff, you know, how to trigger the libs class. However,
yeah,
I have a personal like passion for experimental Latin American magical realism. And half of the funding must go to that. The other half can go to whatever. Yeah. That's the condition.
It's kind of like you see on a CV, you're like University of Austin or whatever, you're like, oh, whatever. Unless it's like from the English literature department, in which case you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like, no one can, oh, you did politics at the University of Idaho. Snore. Oh, you did creative writing at the University of Idaho. I see.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was going to go for like, you know, one of the Christian universities that has like a really good medical school because they want to turn out like good doctors or whatever.
Yeah. Law school.
Like, okay, so you have to, oh yeah, Liberty University Law School. It's like you're insane, but you also know exactly how to suck off which federal judge. No, I mean kind of like the you know, you went to you went to Brigham Young for like medicine or whatever, and it's like, okay, you're a very strange person, but I would trust you to do some like medicine on me.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, do we think that's a good place to cap it all off for this one?
I think so. I would also recommend if people are interested, particularly if you read this and like it, to read the Iliac Crest as well. That's one that I would say stranger than this. And something where I've been more like, man, I don't know. than I have been about this. So that's like advanced difficulty. That's your like extra credit is the Iliad Crest.
If you read the Tega Syndrome and were like, this is too similar to Avengers for me, more obscure and abstruse, please, then you should check out the Iliad Crest. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you once again for joining us for Left on Red. It's going to be my two picks next. My picks are going to be Securitization Theory by Olu Waver. And then also we're going to interview someone I've interviewed before, Jean-Hugues Kabwiku, who is a writer about music and culture, especially how it changes the economies of European cities, about that and post-work. Ooh. So that is all coming up in the next couple episodes of Left on Red.
Thank you for subscribing to the Patreon. But on the other hand, you are getting some extremely interesting sounding content out of it in the near future. So really, you should be thanking us. You're welcome.
You should be thanking us with $5 or possibly $10.
You already are, but you should thank us more than that.
With this one, they're thanking us with $5. They could be thanking us with $10.
Wow. Crazy. You could get like a whole other episode of this every fortnight.
So if you want an whole other episode of this fortnightly, and you want to hear about securitization theory and me talk about international relations again, then that's going to be the $10 inducement. So with all that being said,
be induced.
Yeah, get induced, idiot. With all that being said, thank you for listening, and we will see you on whatever next normal episode goes out after this. Bye, everyone.
Lovely. Bye.